My name is Jürgen Hagen, and I'm the director of the Salisbury Hock Southeast Data Center. I'm also a member of the faculty in the International Relations Department. And it's my great pleasure to see so many of you tonight. This event is organized by the Southeast Asia Center, and I'm delighted that we have Sidney Johns with us here tonight to discuss the ISIS threat in Southeast Asia. But before I introduce Sidney, more comprehensively, let me just say that tonight's event is organized in conjunction with an academic workshop that SAIOC has put together on militant Islamism in Southeast Asia, with a lot of input from my dear colleague, Kirsten Schulze, from the International History Department. Now, many of you won't be able to attend that workshop. It's by invitation only, but you will be able to read the papers once they get published, and we will obviously inform you about that on our website and the various pages, Twitter pages, etc., that we have. Now to tonight's event. It's my great pleasure to welcome Sidney to LSE and to the Southeast Asia Center. Arguably, she doesn't really need an introduction, because anyone who's ever worked on conflict to do with Southeast Asia or terrorism and so on will know her work. She's clearly one of the greatest authorities in this field of study, particularly as regards to maritime countries of Southeast Asia. Now, in terms of her affiliation, Sidney is the founder and director of the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict, which is based in Jakarta. The Institute, by the way, has a great website now that you should all be looking at, especially if you're students. You find a great deal of great reports on that. But prior to founded the Institute, Sidney worked for the International Crisis Group for 11 years until 2013. She has also had positions with the UN, the Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the Ford Foundation. So she's basically done everything. Sidney will speak for 40 to 45 minutes on the question of, was the ISIS threat in Southeast Asia overblown? And we will then go straight to Q&A. So can I please now ask you to turn either your mobiles off or put them on silent, but feel free somehow to still do the odd tweet, and the hashtag you will find there is Jones. Without further ado, may I please now invite you, Sidney, to address the audience. It's really a great delight to have you with us.
Thank you, and good evening, everybody. Very nice to have this kind of reunion with people I've worked with, people I've hung out with in Jakarta, and many others. What I want to do tonight is basically look at some of the apocalyptic warnings that were coming in basically from the time that the caliphate was declared in Syria and Iraq in June 2014, that the next wave of terrorism was going to hit Southeast Asia, and that Southeast Asia could become the second front, a phrase that was also used when Southeast Asia was very much on the radar screen of Al-Qaeda. And there were warnings that had come in not only at the time of the caliphate's formation, but even more so after the city of Marawi was taken over by ISIS fighters. So the fears were basically based on three premises. One of them was that as ISIS collapsed in the Middle East, there were going to be hundreds of fighters looking for a new jihad to wage or for a safe haven or both, and that we could see Southeast Asia flooded with foreign fighters. And in some cases, that was targeted on the Philippines in particular, that one place where anybody could find a safe haven because of porous borders, lack of a government presence, and so on, was southern Philippines. But there was also a concern that we could see a flood of foreign fighters, especially from Indonesia, come back to the region. The second one, and this was particularly the case after the there were intimations of a pro-ISIS coalition in the Philippines, was that ISIS would encourage the formation of a caliphate in Southeast Asia. Now, there was never any chance of a caliphate, but there was a concern that a province of Islamic State would be established in Southeast Asia. And then the final fear was that Marawi, even after its liberation, could become an inspiration for other efforts of a similar nature, either in the Philippines or in elsewhere in Southeast Asia. Although it was clear that in terms of taking control of territory, that there really wasn't anywhere else but the Philippines that was a likely candidate. Now, it's important to do a reality check on exactly what the nature of violent extremism was in Southeast Asia. Because if you look at this chart, the number of deaths from violent extremism linked to ISIS is actually extremely low. We had in Indonesia, if you look at the figures from 2015 to 2017, it's single-digit victims of terrorism linked to ISIS in Indonesia. No fatalities in Malaysia at all. And in the Philippines, before Marawi, where we had the number jump off the charts, it was also relatively low, although the problem in the Philippines is always distinguishing which acts of terrorism were actually committed in the name of ISIS and which were committed in the names of many other organizations, from Abu Sayyaf to the MNLF. But the numbers were relatively low, particularly when you compare them with some of the JI figures from the 2002 to 2004 period. It's also very interesting that even in this period, the Philippines stands out as an area that probably deserved a lot more attention than it got. It was always amazing to me that Indonesia could get so much attention for attacks that actually had very low casualties, whereas far more people were getting killed in the Philippines and no one was paying attention. Also, it's interesting that even though we've had such a low fatality rate, we've actually had quite a high arrest rate, particularly in Indonesia and Malaysia, which indicates a couple of things. It indicates that there is actually a high level of vigilance from the law enforcement officials. And I would say that at least in Indonesia, we're not dealing with arbitrary arrests. The arrests that are taking place are actually based on evidence that the people involved were about to commit or had been somehow involved in terrorist plots. But it's also a factor of incompetence. And one of the things that's been striking about the violent extremists or would-be terrorists operating, particularly in Indonesia and Malaysia, to a lesser extent in the Philippines, is the fact that we're dealing with really low-level bumblers for the most part. For the last several years, we're dealing with people who had no international training, almost no indoctrination. They were almost pulled off the streets or found the pro-ISIS group, sometimes by social media. But there was none of the kind of systematic indoctrination and training that was the case under Jamaah Islamiyah that had been operating before. So for all these reasons, the actual ability to cause mass casualties was quite low. Also, Southeast Asia, at least under ISIS, is a backwater and will continue to be a backwater in the global jihad. For one thing, it's too far away from the center of activity. It's not the heartland of the enemy the way Europe or the US or Australia, for that matter, is. It's not the site of any major proxy conflicts, the way you might see Afghanistan or Iraq. And where you have Muslims involved in ethno-nationalist insurgencies, they're not interested in the global jihad. So southern Thailand, for example, has never been interested in joining Al-Qaeda or ISIS, even though, yes, there are a couple of people maybe who went to Syria, yes, there are a couple of people who have contacts in the Philippines, but by and large, the southern Thai insurgency is not linked to terrorism. Same thing for the Rohingya. We can maybe talk about that a little bit more. Also, there was never a center of Islamic learning and never a group of ulama or Islamic scholars from Southeast Asia that gained the respect of people in the Middle East. So we actually had, in 2005, there was a list put up on a JI website about the ulama that others should follow. This was put up by an Indonesian who was saying, these are the ulama, mostly those who had written radical tracts or who'd been arrested for radical activity. And there were 18 men listed from the Arabian Peninsula, mostly from Saudi Arabia, 9 from Africa, 6 from Jordan. And then it says from Southeast Asia, none. And this kind of plaintive question, why haven't we produced ulama of international caliber? So this was another reason for Southeast Asia being maybe a backwater of the global jihad. Although it's important to note that under Jamaat Islamiya and Al-Qaeda, there was a much more serious look at Southeast Asia to the point where Malaysia became a center where some of the World Trade Center attacks were planned. It was very much the center for transit and finance, not only for Southeast Asia, but beyond as well. We had Hambali, who to this day is the only Indonesian still in Guantanamo, only Indonesia ever detained in Guantanamo, who was a liaison with Al-Qaeda, and for a while being able to link everything that was happening in Southeast Asia to South Asia and back to the Middle East. But since then, since Hambali's arrest in 2003, there's basically been nothing that brings Southeast Asia into the ambit of the heartland of the global jihad. In terms of the foreign fighter issue, it's real, but I think it's important to understand that we're not likely to see a flood of returns. One reason is that the people that have gone to fight for ISIS are a very different kind of individual than went to fight in Afghanistan or went to train along the Afghan-Pakistan border in the 1980s and early 90s. At that point, people were going for training to bring those skills home and fight their home government. So the Indonesians who went wanted to fight Suharto. The Malaysians who went wanted to fight the Malaysian government when they got back. But the people who went to ISIS were interested in staying there to fight what they believed was going to be the final battle between Islam and anti-Islamic forces. This was when the Imam Mahdi was going to come and was going to lead Islamic forces to victory. And it, because there was a hadith which said this would happen in Sham, which was greater Syria, as soon as the Syrian conflict erupted, these apocalyptic hadith became very much topics of discussion and fired up the imagination of young Muslims, not only in Southeast Asia, but in many other parts of the world. So there was a huge interest in Syria from the time it erupted onwards. And the first fighters began leaving in 2013 from Indonesia and Malaysia. We had, especially after the caliphate was declared, oath-taking ceremonies that took place across the region. And we had people so much focused on going to Syria to join the jihad that we actually had a sharp decline in the amount of terrorist activity that was taking place at home, because those people who wanted to commit violence in Southeast Asia were more focused on trying to get to Syria, including after recruiting videos were put up on ISIS media. We also had a Malaysian or a Malay-speaking fighting unit called Fatima Nusantara that was established in September 2014. This again helped provide a focus for people who were going. But by and large, we had a good idea of the people, at least from Indonesia and Malaysia, who were joining ISIS. And it was people who were coming from pretty much existing extremist organizations. People were going as families, so there were many family units going, a high percentage of women and children, and people were going without the intention of coming back. People who went there, including some families who went because they wanted to bring up their children in an Islamic state, had no intention of returning to Indonesia. All of which makes the question of whether there will be large numbers of people returning back to Southeast Asia an open question. There will be some, but it's not going to be a flood. It may be a trickle. And I think for some of the unmarried fighters, there will be efforts to find other jihads, whether it's Libya, Sinai, or somewhat further afield, rather than returning all the way to Southeast Asia. It's also not that easy when you've gone with a family to try to come back with all your family members. It was different when you were coming back by yourself, unmarried, as was the case in Afghanistan. So we have a pretty clear idea, as I say. If you look just at the Indonesian statistics, we can see that as of late 2017, we had probably about 400 people still left in Syria and Iraq. Many of those, again, women and children, but still probably 200 to 300 fighters. We'd had more than 100 people killed. That figure has probably risen in the last several months. And there are over 500 people, again, many women and children, who have been deported back to Indonesia, people who tried to join ISIS but were caught at the border with Turkey and sent back before they could actually cross the border. One of the questions for the Indonesian government is trying to figure out who among the deportees is actually a risk and who is not, since they didn't manage to actually ever get engaged in combat or join military training. We also have this very vague category of returnees, who are the people that we ought to be thinking about as potential risks, people who may have been involved in combat or military experience inside Syria. But in fact, this is a very vague category that includes anybody who crossed over, including to deliver humanitarian aid, and it includes people who had no connection with ISIS as well. So for all of these, we actually have enough information about their biographical data, their backgrounds, and so on, to have a pretty clear picture. But we never had such a good data set on the Philippines, and that's why in some ways Marawi took people more by surprise. Now if you look at the map of the various coalitions, the various groups that contributed to ISIS in the Philippines, we have about six distinct groups, and many of them were operating long before they actually fused into a coalition. We had a splinter of the Abu Sayyaf group operating on Basilan. This was the group that was led by Ismilon Hapilon, who became the Amir. We had a group called AKP, Ansar Khilafa Philippines, operating here. This was a former a splinter of the MILF. We had another splinter of the MILF that was called BIF, the Bangsamoro Islamic Freedom Fighters, broke away in 2008, actually formed BIF in 2010, but it split into three, and two of those factions became pro-ISIS. We had a group that became known as the Maute group after the siblings who led it, Abdullah and Omar Maute, in Lanao del Sur. We had a group called KIM, Khilafah Islamia Movement, operating here in Cagayan. And then we had a cell in Cotabato here that was, unlike all the rest of these, not a splinter of existing armed forces, but actually composed of mostly of university students, including several from computer science, who had been mobilized and inspired by ISIS. So we gradually became aware of how these groups were interacting with one another, and it became clear only very recently that the planning for eventually what was to take place here in Marawi had begun at least a year and a half, if not 2 years earlier. A lot of the initial training for all of this coalition had been in this AKP territory, where they were getting people sent over from Basilan for training. They were getting people sent from Lanao del Sur for training, and then other people in the Maguindanaon area who were also sent for training. So it was very much a conscious decision to train people from these different areas in the interest of having military capacity for the pro-ISIS coalition. And there were also individuals from other parts of Southeast Asia who took part. So we had this Malaysian named Dr. Mahmoud, who was initially he and his colleagues went and joined this area of Basilan in 2014, even before the caliphate was declared. And it was only in late 2016 that he moved over to Lanao del Sur. But he and his colleagues were providing much of the international liaison work, much of the recruiting work, and doing much of the fundraising, including through contacts with ISIS Central. Then we had, this is my favorite, but it's complicated. We had the three Indonesians who were playing key roles with respect to the Philippines. So we had Abu Walid, who has many other names, but let's call him Abu Walid for now, who was an Indonesian. He was from an organization called Kompak. He had trained and fought in Ambon and Poso, the two communal conflicts where Muslims were fighting Christians in the immediate aftermath of Suharto's downfall in Indonesia. He went to Saudi Arabia, where he studied for a couple of years, has fluent Arabic. He was bringing in funds from Saudi Arabia for training in the Philippines in 2004, when he got caught and got arrested. And then he got stuck in prison for the next 9 years. He finally comes to trial in 2013, gets acquitted, gets deported back to Indonesia, marries the widow of a very famous terrorist there, leaves for Syria in May 2014, and then appears in ISIS recruitment videos from 2016 onwards, urging people to go to the Philippines. So this guy is one of the top ISIS leaders in the Philippines. Now these two were in the Philippines, but you realize that there are all sorts of connections between them. He fought in Ambon at the same time as this man named Abu Nida. Abu Nida arrives in Mindanao in September 2003, ends up joining Abu Sayyaf, moves in 2010 to Basilan with Isnilan Hapilan. And then from 2015 onwards, he appears as an explosives instructor in an AKP camp. So just have to look here. If you're wondering how people in Syria connect with people in Mindanao, we have a personal connection between these two Indonesians. And that's not even counting Sucipto Ali, another Indonesian, his real name is Saifuddin Ibrahim. He was arrested in Sabah trying to get back to Indonesia to head Jamaah Islamiyah after the Bali bombs. He had been involved in a bombing in the Philippines in 2002, and the Philippines asked for his extradition from the Malaysian. So he gets extradited, and he's in prison for 9 years at the same time that Abu Walid is in prison for 9 years. We have a match. They know each other. They connect. And he got acquitted in 2014. What does he do? He goes and joins the AKP as an instructor, where he's doing joint training with Abu Nida at the same AKP camp. So all of the people who've been arrested in the Philippines for ISIS activities, who had been involved in training at the AKP camp, all say they had these two guys as instructors. Now, he was killed in late 2015. Abu Nida is still alive. He was in Marawi. He survived Marawi. And just in the last couple of weeks, there has been an arrest of four Indonesians in Sabah trying to get to Mindanao through connections between Abu Nida and some guys in prison in Indonesia. So if you want to talk about how these linkages work, we've got this incredible network of Indonesians and Filipinos and others with ties that were forged in local conflicts, in prisons, and in training camps. Then in the Philippines, we have the leadership shifting to the Mautes in 2016. And you know, some people have wondered, you know, how could these people suddenly emerge out of nowhere? They didn't emerge out of nowhere. This man, Omar Maute, was a student at Al-Azhar, where he married, by the way, an Indonesian. Abdullah Maute had trained and had studied in Jordan, which is where he seems to have met some of the ISIS leadership there. But they only emerge as leaders after our friend, Sucipto gets killed in 2015, and that was in a military operation in the AKP area, and it clearly becomes not safe any longer for the training to take place there. So the training shifts to the Maute brothers and their camp in Lanao del Sur. One thing that the Philippine authorities never picked up on was the extent of religious training that ISIS inspired. So in Indonesia, anybody who's worked there knows about a phenomenon called pengajian. It's religious study groups where you meet once a week usually, and you have a mentor, a scholar who leads you in discussions. And this is the primary recruiting area or recruiting vehicle for extremists in Indonesia. Well, the same thing was taking place in the Philippines, but the Philippine authorities never understood that there could be or had been any kind of radicalization taking place in the Philippines. So we had these young charismatic religious scholars. This is one whose Facebook page is still valid, who were inviting friends, taking ISIS videos, using that as discussion material, at universities and elsewhere, and gradually building up a cadre of pro-ISIS, well-educated, well-off students who ended up playing a major role in the organization, and many of them were women. There were a couple of da'wa organizations, religious outreach organizations, at some of the major Catholic universities in Mindanao, Xavier University, Notre Dame University, and others, where there were Muslim student associations and some of these da'wa groups, and they served as a recruiting vehicle. It's very interesting if you compare Indonesian interrogation depositions with Philippine interrogation depositions, because the Indonesian police know how to ask about where you got radicalized, where were the places that you first heard about ISIS, who were the religious scholars who drew you in. The Philippine police never believed that there was anything actually going on in terms of indoctrination. So none of that information comes out of some of these custodial debriefings. And it's one of the problems that the Philippines is going to have to face for a long time to come. Because I think that the idea of a pure Islamic state as an alternative either to the kind of corrupt democracy that they have now, or indeed to the idea of a Bangsamoro sub-state in the Philippines, is now something that's been planted and will endure long after any connection with ISIS has passed. What were the blinders in the Philippines to actually understanding the nature of the threat? I think there were a number, but I'll just mention three. One of them was a program called Rewards for Justice, run by the United States Department of Justice, that gave a bounty on the head of all of the major terrorists. It's like that deck of cards you used to see in Iraq. But what it meant was that everyone within the security forces was focused on getting individuals rather than trying to understand networks or trying to understand how one group linked to another. Another problem was that at the same time that ISIS was building up and building its infrastructure in the Philippines, the non-ISIS part of the Abu Sayyaf group stepped up their kidnappings for ransom, including of foreigners. And in some cases, they used ISIS flags in their ransom demands to basically up the ante. But in fact, these people doing the kidnappings of foreigners had no connection to the pro-ISIS parts of the ASG, and it deflected the attention of the Philippine authorities. It also meant that they believed that military operations were the only way to deal with this threat. So the only response of the Philippines government throughout this period that ISIS was being built up was military. There was no kind of non-military program that was underway. And then the third blinder was the drug war. From the time that Duterte came in as president in June 2016 until the present, the drug war, in a way, shaped how the president saw the rest of the country. And it meant that there was never a real effort to find out who was behind some of these ISIS activities. So we had a proposal that had come in. Actually, we think now from Abu Walid, that Indonesian in Syria, suggesting to the pro-ISIS coalition that they put together a new Mosul in Marawi. And what did they mean by a new Mosul? They meant a campaign that would involve a military victory, control of territory, and establishment of an Islamic government. The idea was planted that this is what the Philippine ISIS units should do, and I think it must have been planted in sometime in late 2015, because that's when we begin to see the systematic training start that involves all of those different parts of the coalition. Once there was an Islamic government in Marawi, the idea went, you could expand outward, you could go after Iligan, you could go after Cagayan. There was an idea that once established and you had a firm base in Marawi, you could move outward. So the idea wasn't that you immediately engaged the Philippine military, that ended up by accident almost, but it was very much the idea that this was going to be the new Islamic State. And there was a conscious mimicking from the beginning of ISIS, of Mosul images, of the happy fires on trucks, of the planting of the flags and so on. So that was the idea that was behind Marawi from the very beginning. Now, the impact of that, and of course, it scared the hell out of the Philippines government and the neighbors, Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, as well as many of the neighbors in the region, including Australia. But I think perhaps the impact has also been overblown, because it's been a game changer for the Philippines. I'm not sure that Marawi itself is going to turn out to be a game changer for the region more generally. Certainly, it did set a new bar for what extremists can aspire to, that is, military victory and control of territory. But as I say, I don't think there's anywhere else in the region where that can the territory can actually be controlled. It led to increased cross-regional coordination briefly, but nothing in terms of the networks and the web of contacts among Indonesia, Philippines, and Malaysia reached the level that JI had had in the late 1990s. It may have created conditions inside the Philippines that will make Mindanao a base of extremism for a long time to come. And I would include in that the kind of indoctrination that we saw and the kind of coordination that transcended links, regional and ethnic ties in the Philippines. It's also worth noting that there was a large role played in this pro-ISIS coalition by a group called Balik Islam, that is, Christians who converted to Islam, many of whom were from the northern Philippines, not from Mindanao, but from Luzon and the Visayas. And that means it expanded the geographic reach that some of these extremist groups have. They can reach into Manila, and I think we will see activity in Manila. And then it also, Marawi also exposed real major problems in regional cooperation among governments. There's supposed to be a common interest in combating extremism across the region. In fact, it's impossible even to put together a shared watch list of who might be crossing borders. And there are a number of reasons for that. The Malaysians and the Filipinos don't trust each other because of the old historical claim to Sabah. The Indonesians believe, and not just the Indonesians, there's a belief that it's almost betraying your own citizens, your fellow citizens, to give information on them to another country, even if they're terrorists and even if they're criminals. But it's somehow not an appropriate thing to do. So there's a withholding that takes place as well. There's also a distrust, especially on the part of Indonesia and Malaysia toward the Philippines, that if they give sensitive information on individuals, that could leak through clan ties or family ties back into the extremist groups in the Philippines. So for all those reasons, the international cooperation, the regional cooperation didn't work the way it was supposed to. Also, Marawi has put the Philippines back on the map for young jihadis in the region. Just a couple of weeks ago, we had a young Indonesian arrested in Manado on the tip of the island of Sulawesi, who was trying to get to the Philippines. He didn't even know where the Philippines was. And he had an idea that somehow he would be joining an Islamic State that was fully functional, and he would be able to go there and get a job. But it just was indicative of the way that Marawi has somehow now become on the radar screen of people who wasn't there before. So I'm not sure with all of this that Mindanao will now become the safe haven for ISIS fighters from the Middle East or elsewhere, because I just don't believe that it's the place of choice. Back to the idea of Southeast Asia being a backwater for the global jihad. Some people will come, but I think that particular part of the fear of what the implications are of Marawi has been overblown. I'll mention three other nightmare scenarios that have come up in the course of these discussions. One is that top Indonesian leaders in Syria, like Abu Wali, would come back to the region, either to Indonesia or the Philippines, and professionalize these amateurish bumblers who haven't managed to pull off a major attack since 2009. Also, their mission might be to keep the idea of an ISIS regional organization alive. Maybe, but I think police vigilance, particularly in Indonesia and Malaysia, is quite high, and I'm not sure that any kind of systematic training could take place without its being detected. A second nightmare scenario is that violent extremists would somehow manage to exploit growing political influence in Indonesia and Malaysia of hardline Islamists in a way that might provide a gateway to terrorism for some of the above-ground pro-Sharia groups. I don't think this is very realistic. In fact, in both countries, but particularly in Indonesia, the people who are involved in hardline pro-Sharia advocacy and who have taken to the streets in large numbers over the last year have very little connection with the people who are engaged in violent extremism. It's as though they're two separate phenomena. There is some overlap, but very little. And then the third major nightmare scenario that I'll just flag here is that there's a question of whether the Rohingya issue would shift the focus of Southeast Asian extremists away from the Philippines and toward joining the Rohingya insurgency called the Arakanese Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA. So far, however, ARSA itself has rejected any connection with the global jihad, and there's no evidence of any connection to it. So the conclusion is, overall, yes, I think that the threat was a little overblown. On the other hand, I think there are serious issues that remain in Southeast Asia, mostly having to do with the Philippines, where I think the game has significantly changed, but also in Indonesia and Malaysia, where extremists will continue to operate. I think the challenge is to figure out an appropriate way of countering that kind of violent extremism. And one unfortunate consequence of the focus on terrorism, particularly since Marawi, is that the vast amount of aid that has been directed toward the region for CVE, or countering violent extremism, is overwhelming many other sectors of aid that could have gone to poverty alleviation or democracy and governance, and it's vastly exceeded the absorptive capacity of a number of the recipients. So overblown, yes, but keep alert, yes. Thank you.
We'll now get to the question and answer part of the session. I would be very grateful if you could kindly state your name and affiliation when you do get a microphone, and could you please also keep your questions relatively short. Thank you. I think we will start on this side. Gentlemen over there.
Thank you very, very much indeed. Rapidly scribbling notes. The name's Ewan Grant. I'm a former UK law enforcement intelligence analyst. I'm on my way to Kuala Lumpur tomorrow, where I will be meeting people working, but I'm now an independent consultant. Quickly, your final point about the need to focus more on target rather than throw money away. Is there any indication that that message, and the particularly the positive examples of the Malay and Indonesian security agencies in asking the right questions, and that usually means thinking the right questions and considering the answers, is there any indication that that is getting through? The reason I say that is I've worked in the Middle East last year, 17, the blunt instrument challenge and the throwing beyond absorption capacity is a very, very real issue. So is the message getting through to the big money people?
The message is getting through in part, so that there are several targeted efforts now to try and increase cooperation, for example, among Indonesian, Malaysian, and Philippine police. Whether this will work or not, given the obstacles to that cooperation, we don't know, but there's certainly a genuine effort in that direction. I think there are some local efforts that have been very, very successful where, for example, a local group will be designated to receive a group of deportees coming back and then try to understand why they left and ensure that they expand their social network so they're not just going back to the people that they knew when they left. There have also been some successful efforts to take back mosques, for example, that have been taken over by radical groups, but nobody has really done an effort to collect all of these best practices so that there's a kind of a toolkit that can be shared with other places. But there's a lot of, one of the biggest areas of wastage is the area of trying to develop counter-messaging on social media. Because nobody has any idea of how to do that. And you end up getting people, you know, throwing things out into the internet with lots of funding to do that, but without any idea whether it actually works or not.
Thank you. There is a question sort of in the middle of the room, and then we'll go to the gentleman afterwards. Yeah, who's over there? But...
Hi there, James Bellizzi-Lizzi. I'm an intelligence analyst in the private sector. I was wondering whether you could share with us what you know about how some of the terrorist activity in Southeast Asia has been funded.
Lots of different ways. So we had, if you take just Marawi, there was more than $1 million that came in from ISIS Central. The interesting thing was that much of it was laundered through Indonesia and then sent in small amounts through Western Union. You would think that Western Union would be the easiest thing to track. But in fact, when you look at the amount of trade, especially the cloth trade that takes place between Indonesia and Mindanao, and a lot of that money transactions are by Western Union, you can understand why very little of that was picked up. There was there were, in some cases, large donations made by business people in different areas. There was one particularly large donor in Central Java that assisted Indonesians who wanted to leave. There was also in the Philippines, the mother of the Mautes, Farhana Maute, who was an extremely successful businesswoman, donated significant amounts to the cause as well. There was also a lot of looting that took place in Marawi, and it's one of the big questions now about what happens post-Marawi, because I've heard estimates that go up as high as $40 million of cash and looted valuables, which are now in the hands of people who managed to escape Marawi. And that's a real question as to how that can finance a new movement. But there were accusations by the Duterte government that drugs were provided some of the funding. I think it's questionable. There may have been some, but I think it was after the movement was well underway, and it may have been part of a tactical alliance between the drug lords of Marawi and the Mautes who were controlling them. By and large, in Indonesia, those going to Syria finance themselves, selling everything that they have to go, and there's been very little money coming in from ISIS Central or other sources.
Okay, last question from this side of the room for now. The gentleman over there.
Hi there, my name is Joseph Orchard. I'm a journalist and writer. I was interested in a couple of points you made about Malaysia in particular. Firstly, at the beginning, regarding the statistics, and then lastly about the exploitation of political space by extremists. I was particularly interested in what you have observed and others have observed about the preponderance of Bangladeshi extremists, to varying degrees linked to attacks or extremism, or indeed actions of the political right in that country, in Bangladesh, who take shelter in Malaysia. And I mean, I was interested to what your comments on that are, and also how that occurs. Essentially, is that an issue? Does that not reflect a degree of political consent in much the same way that somewhere like Pakistan with LET attempts to, or through its intelligence agencies, or through political power, attempts to project attacks outside rather than having them come in?
The Bangladeshi students who, for example, took part in the Holy Bakery attack in Dhaka in July 2016 were certainly not working for any government or not acting as the projecting force of any intelligence agency or anything. And I don't think there was any interest in the Malaysian government of harboring such extremists. I think it's a source of deep concern to the Malaysian government that they don't know among the Bangladeshis who come there either to study or to work who could be an extremist, and they certainly don't want them. There was one man who was linked to to some murders in Bangladesh, who was trying to get to Marawi, and who actually had made contact with the Malaysian Dr. Mahmoud. He was caught at the airport by the Malaysian government, and even though he was under a death sentence because he'd been tried in absentia in Bangladesh, he was deported. There was no interest in the Malaysian government in harboring or supporting these guys.
Okay, let's have some questions from this side of the room now. The gentleman sitting, just over there.
Okay, thank you so much, Sydney. I'm up in the Department of War Studies, King's College. What's your view of the influence of the new ISIS leaders in Southeast Asia, such as Amin Bhatt?
I have very mixed feelings about Amin Bhatt. We call him Bhatt because we say C is CH, so I don't know whether the real Bugis is Bhatt or Bhatt, my Indonesian friends say Bhatt. Amin Bhatt is someone with a Dar al-Islam background, and he had been the person who was ferrying Indonesians from Tawau in Sabah through the island chain of Tawi Tawi to Zamboanga and so on throughout the period 2002-2003 up until quite recently. And in 2006, he was named to or instructed to build the Dar al-Islam cell in Tawau. But so he's somebody who is a Malaysian citizen of Bugis descent and therefore close to the Indonesians, but who married into a very important clan in Jolo in the Philippines. So he managed to be a bridge internationally among Indonesia, Malaysia, and the Philippines, as well as being a bridge among different factions of the Abu Sayyaf from the non-ISIS to the pro-ISIS. What he didn't have was any religious credentials whatsoever, as far as I know. And that's why I think it's unlikely that he would be taken on as Amir. The news that he was appointed Amir after Ismailan Hapilon's death came from an Indonesian who was arrested trying to swim away around Lake Lanao and was caught and taken back. And he said, because he was in the room at the time, that after Ismailan and Omar Maute were shot, Amin Bhatt took over command of the remaining people in that room. That does not make him an Amir. That makes him a temporary commander of a bunch of stragglers in Marawi. Whether it's more than that, I don't know. But I would be skeptical that he is the new ISIS leader. Important, yes. Important for those liaison roles. But I think if I was going to name the top ISIS leaders now that are left, number one would be Abu Dar, also known as Owaida, also known as Humam Abdul Najid, who led that group in Cagayan. Very well educated, good record of terrorist activities, good record of... So he's got everything going for him. Also, this guy Ismail Abdul Malik, who's been fighting the MILF in Maguindanao. He's also somebody who has the potential to take on a bigger leadership role, except that I think the most influential people in the Philippines from here on in are going to be ethnic Maranao.
All right. There's a lady just over there. Yeah, yes.
Thank you. My name is Yen Yen from BBC Monitoring. Thank you very much for the talk, by the way, really informative. I'm just wondering, has there ever been any indication, have you seen any indication of what links the Southeast Asian leaders have to IS Central in the Middle East? It's never been very clear to us. And then also,
they clearly had ongoing links to the people from Southeast Asia in ISIS. So they had regular communication, it looks like, with Bahrum Shah, who was running Katiba Nusantara, and or Abu Wali. There is some indication that Dr. Mahmoud had independent links to ISIS Central, but not sure to whom. And there were rumors, but also never proven, that Abdullah Maute knew Baghdad al-Baghdadi somehow from his time in Jordan. But also, it's never been proven. But that there was ongoing communication with Syria, yes.
Okay, so the gentleman sitting right next to
Hi, Sydney. Thank you for your talk. My name is David. I'm from IHS Market. Just one quick question about we're quite taken about the fact that the current groups in Southeast Asia, for example, the more radical Rohingyas and the insurgents in the Deep South, are unlikely to become a serious threat. But what, in your opinion, would be some of the key indicators of, say, escalated possibilities of threat? Then forming into a more serious challenge to Southeast Asia's safety.
From these ethno-nationalist insurgencies?
Yeah, so for
so I think that, I don't think we're,
it's always bad to make predictions, right? But I don't think
we're likely to see Southern Thailand or the Southern Thais at this stage ever become a serious part of the extremist movement in Southeast Asia. I think it's different with the Rohingya. It's a big question mark. At the moment, ARSA, this Arakanese Rohingya Salvation Army, has stated repeatedly, you can take that for what it's worth, that they are not interested in the global jihad and that they are only fighting for the Rohingya. But one thing that's true about Rohingya organizations is that they always splinter. And there might be a chance of a more militant splinter group emerging that would find links and perhaps funding from radical organizations. The biggest likelihood is that there would be some kind of association between such a splinter and a group like LET in Pakistan. But I think the longer the situation drags out in the camps in Bangladesh, the higher the likelihood that such a splinter would emerge.
Okay, right. So, okay, to James, but there's this gentleman who's been waiting patiently, and did you get the microphone from the master?
Yes, my name's Mark Wilson, a means colleague at BBC Monitoring. Thanks for the talk, and thanks for all your reports, fantastic. My question was about Barham Shah and Khatibeh Nusantara. What are those guys up to at the moment? I know it's maybe a tough question, but what are your sources telling you on that front? And if they're not, what's your perceptions on that and where they might head next?
Okay, so Bahram Shah and Abu Wali apparently were both in Raqqa at the time Raqqa fell, and they moved to Dar ez-Zor, and then Dar ez-Zor fell. And I don't know where they are now. The last communication we heard about from either of them, and even that was indirect, was through telegram chats at the height of the Marawi crisis, and it was in late July or early August where Bahram Shah was actually signing on supposedly to statements that were coming out of Syria. But nothing has come out since. But we also have heard nothing that would suggest he had died, and he is somebody of enough stature that I think it would be very unlikely that he would be killed without word getting back. Very recently, Bahram Naim was announced to have been killed on November 30th. And that seems to have been confirmed by the family, although it's still not 100%. But I think there's a strong likelihood that he really is dead. The Bahram Shah, just don't know.
Okay, I think it's James.
Thanks, Sydney. As
James Butzel from the Department for International Development here at the school. Thanks. Your analysis is always spot on and very convincing. I wanted to make three points about the Philippines, though, that for you to comment on. What seems particular, first of all, is that, I mean, this really was a game changer in the Philippines. So there's a step change in this terrain. And where it goes is not, unlinked with what happens with the peace process, with the MILF in particular. Because the people, just like in Syria, you know, we have serious commanders who have years of experience who can become, you know, alienated, and young people too. So that really makes a difference. And Maute brothers tapped into that, and that's what, you know, that's one. Second, that there really is a very serious black economy in the region that can finance quite a lot and has done in the past and could be tapped into in a much bigger way. And we know that in these movements, while yes, you need ulama and a religious, serious religious figures to emerge, at the same time there are a lot of tactics and tactical alliances that go on. So it seems to me that for those reasons, there's a particular new set of issues in the Philippines. The only other thing is on Rohingya, and that is, if we think about North Africa, to some extent, these ten groups and this organizational network was almost created by the accusation that they existed and the establishment of the U.S. North African command. And it seems to me there is that danger in talking about the Rohingya, that it becomes a, to some extent, fulfilled through the actions to resist it.
Yeah. Let me just comment on the peace process first. First of all, I think the peace process is dead. I don't think it's going anywhere. I don't think that Duterte has any interest in a Bangsamoro substate. And I think Marawi has created a whole new wave of Islamophobia that will militate against any substate being formed. That said, I think the MILF had begun to lose credibility long before Marawi erupted. So I think that you're right that the Maute's tapped into that even before it became clear that the process wasn't going anywhere. But I think the MILF credibility was really badly hurt by Marawi, because the Maranaos thought, if the MILF can't protect us, who can? And they were as angry against the MILF as they were against the Maute's for starting it, and even more against the government for the airstrikes. They're angry at everybody. And I think that there is a very good chance that we will see a new Maranao-based insurgency emerge that will take the remaining Maranaos from the MILF into that new movement. So I think the peace process is what we used to say was the solution to extremism. Get the peace process and the extremists will be marginalized. That's not true any longer. So I think we have to wait and see where that goes. But I would watch the Maranao area very closely. It doesn't have to be a pro-ISIS insurgency, but I think it will be an Islamist insurgency. On the black economy, yes, there is lots of money available. And as I'm sure you know, Pancho Lada has written this great book on shadow economies, where he does a very good job of laying out all the ways in which all armed insurgencies get funded by everything from illegal logging to drugs. And I think that will be the case as some of these pro-ISIS components revert to their home units. Even now, we're seeing this BIF unit in Maguindanao kill a number of indigenous people and burn a lot of indigenous homes for something that had nothing to do with ISIS. It's back to an old feud that goes back years. And so there's nothing which says, because you're ISIS, you therefore can't have all these other traditional concerns at the same time. Finally, on Rohingya, yes, I would agree that if you keep harping on the possibility that we're going to have a militant movement and take all these steps to try to prevent it, you may end up with a self-fulfilling prophecy. But let's hope the Rohingya are wiser than that.
We will now start collecting questions. I will take three questions. Yeah, please keep your questions short. We'll start in this row over there and then move our way up. Yeah. So start with you first.
Hi, my name is Alpha. I'm a student here at the LSE. My question is, I'm interested in what you said about the response of the Philippines police to the radicalization problem. Do you think that the security forces in the Philippines and in the wider region are more prepared now to counter this radicalization problem?
Okay, thank you. Sorry, there was a gentleman right over here, sort of halfway.
Oh yeah, hi there. My name is Jack Broom. I'm a conflict studies master's student at LSE. I was wondering, has there been any evidence of connection between movements in Indonesia and Philippines with movements in East Pakistan and Xinjiang?
Okay, and then the third one over here.
Hi, my name is Eugene. I'm a student at King's. I'm just wondering if you could share with us what your thoughts are about what ASEAN can and should do in this issue.
Thank you very much.
Okay, every time I hear the word ASEAN, my eyes glow. So I think, in fact, that ASEAN is a good, but it doesn't have a major role to play in counterterrorism. I think most of the progress has been made on bilateral or trilateral basis because there's just much more concrete steps that can be taken when two countries are involved rather than when you have to get consensus of the whole group. The Turkestan issue, my favorite question. Thank you for asking. So yes, very interesting episodes of Uyghurs coming into Indonesia and into the Philippines and into Malaysia who have ended up joining extremist operations, at least in Indonesia. And they have, we know at least in one case, there's a clear link to the Turkestan Islamic Party. The Chinese insist on calling it ETIM, but as I understand it, ETIM hasn't existed for a while, and it's TIP. But I think that some of the Uyghurs who ended up in Indonesia were duped. And what happened was we had had since 2014 at least an underground railway operating from Xinjiang into Southeast Asia to get thousands of Uyghurs to Turkey, which is where they wanted to go to start a new life. And the UNHCR at one stage in Malaysia told me that the Uyghurs in Malaysia were their biggest success story and they didn't have to lift a finger because they would get to KL and then there would be, through various mechanisms, assistance provided so they got to Turkey. But there were also some fixers in Malaysia who had connections, I think, both to TIP, but certainly to the Indonesian extremist groups. And they were themselves of Uyghur descent. And it seems, at least from the depositions that we've seen from the Uyghurs in Indonesia, they kind of hung around the Turkish embassy in Kuala Lumpur, listening for people who spoke Uyghur. And then going up and talking to them and convincing them that they could actually either get to Turkey faster by going to Indonesia in some cases, or that they could play a role in helping Xinjiang. And there apparently had been a decision made by TIP at some stage around 2014 that they would try to beef up their own capacity by having Uyghurs join existing conflict movements or existing insurgencies in Southeast Asia. And this became particularly the case after it became harder to get into Syria. So we had 12 or 13 Uyghurs who ended up in Indonesia. Six of them are dead, five of them are in detention, and one of them was deported. And in the Philippines, Philippines, there were four Uyghurs that came through and apparently visited some of the groups, but then were caught by the Philippine government and deported. We have the mystery of the Uyghurs who were supposedly involved in the Erawan shrine bombing in Bangkok. As far as we know, there's no connection between those Uyghurs and our Indonesian Uyghurs. The fact is that it's very difficult to tell who's telling the truth completely. One of the poor Uyghurs who ended up in Batam, on the island between Singapore and Sumatra, was someone who sounds like he was duped, but he had actually come from Kashgar to Malaysia on a fake Kyrgyz passport, actually ended up in Indonesia and couldn't communicate, so he had to use Google Translate to communicate with his Indonesian associates, who kept trying to convince him to be a suicide bomber. And the poor guy eventually said, "I decided I'd rather die in Indonesia than die in China." But fortunately, he got arrested. Yes, there was a connection, that long-winded answer. Are the Philippine security forces more prepared than they were before? The interesting thing about the Philippines is, unlike Malaysia and Indonesia, the lead agency is the military, not the police. And I haven't seen anything that suggests the police are now better informed about radicalization than they were before. I think maybe there are some in the military, but the amount of disinformation and false information coming out of the military throughout the Marawi siege was such that I wouldn't put a lot of faith in that either.
All right, thanks. I mean, that's another round of questions. If we can start here at the front this time.
Hi, I'm Ting Hao. I'm a current student in AFC. So just now you mentioned about one of the reasons why Southeast Asia is a backwater in the global jihad is the region's Muslims are involved mostly in ethno-nationalist insurgents, right? So my question is, like, how likely that these ethno-nationalist insurgencies will be evolved or merged into terrorism?
Okay.
There was a question over there, so give the microphone.
Thank you, Professor Jones. My name is Ben Leong. I'm a student here at the LSE in the International History Department. My question is, do you think that the current situation with the loosely worked out regional cooperation and the continuing sort of lingering threat would justify increasing presence of U.S. intelligence or some sort of presence to mitigate this threat? Thank you.
Thank you. We're going back to the lady over there.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if we could expand on it, as in with the East Turkestan question. There have been arrested quite a lot of foreigners in Malaysia, and then also that odd incident of a Malaysian being caught at the Pakistan airport going to Thailand with weapons. Do you think these are all incidental, kind of perhaps people trafficking or other sort of criminal lines going through Malaysia, or have you seen any evidence of credible links to other kind of Islamist or terrorist groups elsewhere?
Okay, I'm going to take two more. The young lady here, the second row.
Hi, I'm Heather. I'm a student at LSE. I was just wondering what you thought about the poll that we just did, what your answer would be to that.
Okay.
Okay, and then there was the final question comes from the gentleman over there, yes.
Hi, thank you. My name is Shukri, the student from UCL. I have a question regarding, can you expand more about if there is any affiliation between these terrorist groups with any political party, particularly in Malaysia or Indonesia, and if so, if there is not, can you expect if there is any connection or any signaling from these groups if they have any plan to increase their political legitimation in Southeast Asia?
Thank you very much.
Wow. Okay. So on the ethno-nationalist issue to terrorism, I think one of the reasons why it's unlikely is that the whole cause of fighting for your own area of autonomy or your own independence would be jeopardized if you expanded outwards to a broader constituency. Also, in some cases, you want support of Western governments, and you don't get support from Western governments if you're also an extremist organization. So those are two reasons why it's harder to see how why you would be interested in making the transition. Also, you don't want to be put on a terrorist list where it makes it impossible for governments or other organizations to undertake mediation or political negotiations. So those are some other reasons why it's unlikely that you would see crossover to terrorism. On U.S. intelligence in the on these areas, I find it interesting that the United States had special forces in Basilan from 2002 onwards, and they didn't seem to pick up on what was going on. There's a very interesting article, if anybody's interested, that came out in a website called War on the Rocks. Just do War on the Rocks and then search for the Philippines. But it's written by a former special forces person who was involved in intelligence, and he said the focus of Washington was all on combat training, and that they actually weren't that interested in trying to understand the networks, and the tours of duties were so short that there wasn't an opportunity to try and expand that kind of knowledge base that might have helped them get a better picture of what was going on. So I don't think they played a stellar role. In terms of the linkages between some of these extremist groups and criminal organizations, I don't know in terms of the specific cases, but in general, the Indonesian extremist groups have been pretty clean of links to drug traffickers or people traffickers or some other aspects of organized crime. One case maybe, but by and large, no. The Philippine organizations, it's much murkier. I think it is worth asking in every case what kind of links to this kind of shadow economy exist. In Thailand, on the Thai-Myanmar border, it's just a huge number of linkages to especially drug trafficking groups, and that has funded some of the Thai insurgent activities. Not sure at the moment where some of the Rohingya are getting their funds from, but I do think that you need to take it case by case and look without making generalizations across the board. On your poll, I saw that, I mean, it was loaded questions anyway, but the answer that you all picked overwhelmingly was that in order to counter violent extremism effectively, you need to base it on targeted research about how radicalization occurred in the first place. So yes, that's the right answer. But I would also say, I was surprised that the second largest response was in support of interfaith dialogues toward mutual understanding, because I actually am a skeptic of interfaith dialogues, and I think they tend to turn into gab fests of people who would talk to each other anyway. And they work in certain cases where they are directly tied to grassroots programs at a community level, and where the dialogue can actually result in concrete efforts, for example, to have a computer literacy training program that involves students from both communities in a way that builds bonds between them, yes, then it works. Is that all? The between extremist groups and political parties. I think that it's that first of all, political parties mostly want to steer as clear as possible from some of these groups. That said, I think there are ways in which some parties with hardline backers end up being apologists in some ways for extremist groups, or who get involved in, as in Indonesia, in campaigns to disband the counterterrorism unit of the police because it seemed to stigmatize Islam and so on. What's interesting is the flip side of your question, which is, do any of the extremist groups see any legitimacy in some of the political movements? And what we've seen recently with Jamaah Islamiyah, which is still alive and well in Indonesia, is that some members have said, if you say that our goal is the achievement of an Islamic state, then the above-ground pro-Sharia advocacy groups have achieved a lot more than we ever did by using violence. So that in that case, maybe we ought to think about political infiltration as a strategy in our arsenal. And that's still an ongoing debate within the organization.
Thank you very much. I think we've now run out of time, so I have to draw this to a close, I'm afraid. Thank you so much for sharing what has been truly fascinating insights into extremist and terrorist groups in Southeast Asia and their various links. I think we've all benefited greatly from your enormous encyclopedic expertise. And so please join me in thanking Sydney for a wonderful... Thank you.